in fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned.
Crooked letter, crooked letter. The first thing he noticed was that they didn't have coats. It was just after dawn in March, 1979, a Monday. Larry's father driving him to school and dragging a fume of blue exhaust behind his Ford pickup. The spring holidays had come and passed, but now a freakish cold snap had frozen the land, so frigid his mother's chickens wouldn't even leave the barn. The evergreens a blur outside the frosted truck window, and him lost in yet another book. He was in seventh grade and obsessed with Stephen King and looked up from Salem's Lot when his father braked. The pair of them were standing at the bend in the road by the store, a tall, thin black woman and her son, about Larry's age, a rabbit of a boy he'd seen at school, a new kid. He wondered what they were doing here, this far out, before the store opened. Despite the cold, the boy wore threadbare jeans and a white shirt, and his mother a blue dress the wind curved over her figure. She wore a cloth around her hair, breath torn from her lips like tissues snatched from a box. His father passed without stopping, Larry turning his head to watch the boy and his mother peer at them from outside. Larry turned. "Daddy?" "Ah, durn," said his father, jabbing the brakes. He had to back up to meet them. Then he leaned past Larry on the truck's bench seat, an army blanket placed over it by his mother, and rattled the knob, and they were in a burst of freezing air that seemed to swirl even after the woman had shut the door. They were all forced together, Larry against the boy on one side and his father on the other, uncomfortable because he and his father almost never touched, awkward handshakes, whippings. For a moment, the four sat as if catching their breath after a disaster, the truck idling. Larry could hear the boy's teeth clacking. Then his father said, "Larry, throw a log on that dad blame fire. Warm these folks up." He turned the heater to high, and soon the black boy beside Larry had stopped shivering. "Alice," said his father, pulling onto the road, "introduce these young'uns." "Larry," the woman said, as if she knew him, "this is Silas." "Silas, this is Larry." Larry stuck out his calfskin glove. Silas's slender brown hand was bare, and despite the quick soul shake it gave, Larry felt how cold his skin was. If he gave him one of his gloves, they could each have one warm hand. He wanted to do this, but how? They smelled like smoke, Silas and his mother, and Larry realized where they must live. His father owned over 500 acres, much of it in the bottom right corner of the county, and on the southeast end, a half a mile from the dirt road, if you knew where to look, was an old log hunting cabin centered along with a few trees in a field a few acres across, just a little bump on the land. Bare furnishings inside, dirt floor, no water or electricity, heated by a wood stove. But when had they moved in, and by what arrangement? His father and the woman called Alice were talking about how cold it was. "Freeze my dad blame can off," his father said. "Mm-hmm," she said. "You ever seen the like?" "No, sir. Not even in Chicago?" She didn't answer. And when the silence became awkward, His father turned the radio up and they listened to the weatherman saying it was cold. It was going to stay cold. Leave your tap water running tonight so your pipes wouldn't freeze. Larry stole a look at the boy beside him and then pretended to read his book. He was terrified of black kids. The fall after the summer he turned 11, he had entered the 7th grade. Recent redistricting of county schools had removed him from the public school in Folsom and forced him to go to the Chabot School, where 80% of the student population and a lot of the teachers and the vice principal were black. Most of the kids are the men who worked in the mill or cut trees or drove log trucks. Everything Larry couldn't do, spike a volleyball, throw a baseball, football, or catch one, field a grounder, fire a dodgeball, these black boys could, did. They manipulated balls as if by magic, basketball swishing impossibly, baseball swiped out of the air, fierce-eyed boys hurling and curving through their lives as smoothly as boomerangs. None read, though, or understood Larry's love for books. Now he glanced over and saw Silas's lips tense and his eyes moving across Larry's page. "What grade you in?" Larry asked. Silas looked at his mother. "Tell him," she said. "Seventh," he said. "Me too." In Folsom, his father dropped the boys off at school. Alice climbing out and then Silas. Larry aware how unusual, inappropriate, it was for black people to be getting out of a white man's truck. As he slid across the seat, Larry glanced back at his father, who faced the road. Silas had disappeared, probably as aware as Larry of the oddity of their situation. And Larry stepped past the woman called Alice, seeing for the first time, as she smiled at him, how lovely she was. "Goodbye," she said. "Bye," he mumbled, and walked off with his books. He glanced back once and saw his father saying something, the woman shaking her head. At lunch in the cafeteria, he looked for Silas among the black boys who occupied the two center tables, but didn't see him. He had to be careful, because if they caught him looking, they'd beat him up later. As usual, he sat with his tray and milk a few feet down from a group of white boys. Once in a while, they'd invite him over, but not today. His mother picked him up that afternoon, as usual, and, as usual, quizzed him about his day. She seemed surprised about their morning passengers. She asked where they'd been standing. "They didn't have coats," he said. "They were freezing." "Where do they live?" she asked. He sensed he had said too much already, though, and said he didn't know. For the rest of the ride, his mother was quiet. Wherever Alice and Silas lived, they were there the next morning, same place, same time. His father pulled the truck over, and the smell of wood smoke blew into the cab with the icy wind. And soon they all rode silently, side by side. Larry opened Salem's lot and held it so he was sure Silas would notice. It was the best part, where the girl came back as a vampire, floating there at Ben's window. Wednesday and Thursday passed, each day the black people waiting, his mother picking him up in the afternoon and quizzing him on the morning trip. Did the woman seem friendly to his father? How did his father act? Was he stiff, the way he could be, was, most of the time? Or was he, "Why do you care?" Larry asked. She didn't answer. "Well, Mama, I don't care," she said. "I'm just curious about your day." "I think," he said, "where it had hurt her. They live in that old place down on the southeast acreage." "Do they?" said his mother. At supper that night, he could tell something was wrong. He had told Larry to feed the chickens when he'd already done it, and his father had to be reminded to say the blessing. Now neither of his parents spoke as they sat around their dining table and passed squash and meatloaf. And just before she rose to gather their dishes, his mother announced that she would drive Larry to school the following day in her car. His father glanced at Larry. "How come, Ina?" "Oh," she said, "in the morning that gas man's coming, and I can't talk to him. You've got to tell him to come every week, and make sure he understands. Besides," she took the dishes to the sink and returned to the table, "I've got some things to return at Bedsole's." His father nodded, then looked at Larry before pushing back from the table and bending into the refrigerator for a Budweiser and opening it with his pocket knife on the way to his chair to watch the news. "Carl?" His mother set a pie plate down, a little hard. "Enjoyed it," he called back. As Larry dried the plates his mother handed him, he understood that he'd betrayed a trust between himself and his father. And the next morning, in his mother's Buick, he turned at the bend in the road where Alice and Silas waited, shivering, holding on to one another. As his mother slowed, Larry saw Silas push away from Alice, just as he would have done. Her drawn face pretty despite how the cold made her lips tiny, her skin the color of coffee the way women drink it, her hair in a scarf, but her eyes large and frightened. "Honey," said Larry's mother, "roll down your window, please." Without looking away from the woman, Larry turned his window crank. "Hello, Alice," his mother called as the glass descended. "Miss Ina," Alice said. She stood very straight. Silas had stepped back, turned his face away. Larry's mother reached over the seat behind them and withdrew a paper grocery bag. From it, she took two heavy winter coats, old ones from their hall closet, one of hers for Alice and one of Larry's for Silas. "These should fit," she said, funneling them out the window, Larry's hands poking at the coats, warm from the car's heater, from the heat of their closet before that, and before that, the heat of their bodies, now going out the window to the bare black fingers in the cold. Alice held her coat, didn't even put it on. For a moment, Silas glared at both Larry and his mother. Then he stepped back. "You've never minded," Larry's mother said to Alice, looking hard at her, "using other people's things." Then she pressed the accelerator and left them holding their coats in Larry's side mirror. In a moment, his mother touched his knee. "Larry?" He looked at her. "Ma'am?" "Roll up your window," she said. "It's freezing." Cut to a bit later, when Larry is walking out in the woods to go and try to find Silas. As he made his way toward the cabin where Silas and his mother were staying, the woods began to thin. As he came to the edge of the field with his .22, he looked over the frozen turn rows and saw the dark elbow of smoke from the cabin stovepipe. He knelt, a fallen log at the tree line like a wall, the bramble cross-stitching his face so they'd never see him from the windows. He knew the cabin, had been there before, had pushed open its door on leather hinges and peered into the dust and dark, where fissures of light showed how poorly the logs were mortared. There'd been little else to see, a wooden table and a couple of single beds hunters used, a wash pot. The stove in the back corner with its iron door opened and its pipe a straight line to the roof, sheared around the top with bent, blackened patches of aluminum. A wood box coated in dust, which held only dead cockroaches and rat droppings when he raised its lid. He wondered now, watching the cabin, if Silas did his homework by firelight. He'd have to lug the water from the creek on the other side of the field, where the trees resumed. Larry wondered if he could get closer, if he should circle the edge of the woods to the point nearest the house. "Hey," a voice said behind him. He turned with the rifle. It was Silas, his arms full of limbs, firewood, The black boy dropped the wood and raised his hands like a robber. For a moment, that was how they stood. Sallis in the coat Larry's mother had given him, and one of Larry's old thermal caps his mother must have thought to put in the pocket. Sallis opened his mouth. "You gonna shoot me?" He moved the rifle. "No," he said. "You scared me, Zol, sneaking up like that." "I ain't sneak." Sallis lowered his hands. "Sorry," Larry said. He put the .22 against the tree and hesitated, then came forward to shake Silas's hand, his father's habit. Silas hesitated too. Then, perhaps because they were alone in the woods, no school around them, they shook. Silas's fingers again enveloped in Larry's glove. For a moment, they looked at each other, then knelt together to pick up the wood. Larry stacked his limbs onto the top of the pile Sallis held. Sallis shrugged a thanks and stepped past Larry and went to the edge and stopped. He looked back over his shoulder. "What you doing out here?" "My daddy owns this land." Larry turned to where the gun stood, barrel up, against the bark of a pine tree. "I was hunting." "You kill anything?" Larry shook his head. "'Cause I ain't heard no shots." "I'm hunting deer," Larry said. "I had me a gun. I kill some of these squirrels. Let Mama fry them." Larry's hand reached for his .22. "You reckon I could borrow that?" Silas said. "I bet your daddy got 25 more, ain't he?" "He did. Carl had several guns. Larry brought this one because it didn't kick and wasn't as loud as the others. 12 and 20 gauge shotguns or higher caliber rifles." "How y'all get to town now?" Larry asked. "Mama got a car." "How'd she get it?" "I don't know. How'd your daddy get his truck?" "Paid for it." They stood. Silas looked toward the cabin, then dropped the wood again and turned, pointed to the .22. "Let me shoot it." Larry looked toward the house. "Won't your mama here?" "She working." "I thought she worked in the Piggly Wiggly, the early shift." "She do. Then she worked the late shift at the diner in Folsom." "Here go," he said, stepping forward and taking the gun from Larry, who never even tried to stop him. "How you do it?" Silas asked. "It's already one in the chamber," Larry said. "All you gotta do is cock it and shoot." "How you shoot?" "You ain't never shot?" "I ain't never touched no gun," Silas said. He held the rifle by its stock and forestock, as if it were a barbell without weights. Larry raised his arms and mimed how you'd aim the gun. "Which hand are you?"
"Say what?"
"Right-handed or left?"
"I'm right."
"Left."
"So you're opposite me. See that hammer there?"
Larry pointed. "Cock it back." Silas did, and Larry watched him raise the rifle to his right cheek. "Lay your face on the wood," he said.
"Cold," Silas said.
"Now close your left eye and look with your right down the barrel. See that sight? Put that on whatever you want to hit." Silas aimed at something across the field, closer to the cabin than Larry liked, and then shot, and the echo slapped through the trees.
"It ain't loud," Silas said. He lowered the rifle and peered toward where he had fired.
"That's how come I like it," said Larry.
"Can I shoot it again?"
"Go on."
"How many bullets you got?"
"Cartridges. This one shoots cartridges. 22 longs."
"It shoot 22 times?"
Larry had to smile. "No, this gun's a 22 caliber. It shoots long or short cartridges. I got longs today."
"How many you got?"
"Enough." Silas raised it again and sighted down the barrel and pulled the trigger. Nothing happened.
"Work the lever," Larry said, miming.
Silas levered the rifle, and his head snapped when the spent hull flew out of the side.
"Now see how it's cocked? It's ready to shoot again, so be careful."
Holding the rifle with a kind of reverence, Silas bent to retrieve the hull.
"It's hot," Larry said. But Silas picked it up with his fingers and then cupped it in his palm.
What you do with these?
Larry shrugged.
Throw them away.
Silas put the cartridge to his nose.
Smell good.
Gunpowder.
Gunpowder.
They watched each other.
Then Silas raised the rifle again and panned it over the field, past the house, all the way back to Larry, and held it on him. For a moment, Larry saw into the perfect O of the barrel and followed it to Silas's opened eye and went numb.
Now we even, Silas said.
Then he moved the gun, continued his pan until he stopped on a pine tree and shot. He levered the rifle and this time caught the ejected hull. It clicked against the other in his palm. Then he put them both in his coat pocket, and it struck Larry with a wave of sadness, a boy saving the hulls as something valuable.
Go on, keep it, Larry blurted. The rifle.
Silas, when he smiled, displayed an array of handsome teeth.
For real?
It was the first time Larry had seen him smile. I gotta get it back, though, pretty soon, okay? Promise?
I'll just shoot me a few of these squirrels, Silas said.
He sighted something high in a tree.
You got the bullets? The cartridges?
Larry unzipped his coat pocket and brought out both of the small white boxes and held them out to the black boy. Silas took them reverently and transferred them to his own coat pocket. Larry showed him how to load it and gave him pointers about aiming and shooting, the same lessons his father had given him. By the time he finished telling Silas how to clean the rifle, the sky outside the woods had reddened, and the limbs were darker, and the smoke from the cabin had quit.
Oh, man, Silas said,
grabbing all the wood he could gather in one hand, gun in the other. That fire go out, my mama kill me dead. With sticks pointing in every direction, he raced toward the sun. And only when Larry could no longer discern the rifle barrel from sticks of firewood did he himself turn and walk back into the forest where night had already begun to gather its folds. He felt welcomed by it and full of air. The last thing he did was pull at the fingers of his gloves, removing the left one, the right, and erect the stick in the shape of a Y in the cold mulch beneath the leaves. On each peg, he left a glove.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email, and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.